introduce tonight's speaker. Please join me now in extending a warm welcome to Raymond.
Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, then maybe I should cover it up. Hi everybody, my name is Ray, I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. People that know me know that I say that every time I introduce myself, so I'd like to tell you where I got that from. So my original home group was the 25th Street group in downtown Newport News, and it was mostly men there. And there was one guy named Little Tracy. They called him Little Tracy because he was like 6'5". Weird nickname, but he always said that. And he would say that he was grateful, but he wasn't grateful enough. Meaning that no matter what he did for Alcoholics Anonymous, it would never equal what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for him. And that's exactly how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's done miraculous things for me in my life, and I'm so grateful, but not grateful enough. My sobriety date is today. Today, I got sober 25 years ago today. So, January 13, 1998. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I've worked the 12 steps of the program with my sponsor, and I've worked them with other men, and as a result of this course of action, I've gotten a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. And what does it mean that I have a spiritual awakening? It doesn't mean that I'm a saint. I still do things I shouldn't do, and I still maybe say the wrong things sometimes. I'm not always spiritual. Sometimes I could be a little bit of an a-hole. Let's just put it that way. But what it means to me is that I'm a much better human being than I used to be, and that I'm a guy that doesn't drink and doesn't think about drinking. And if you're a real alcoholic like I am, that's miraculous. When you don't drink and you don't think about drinking, that's really a phenomenal state of being for us alcoholics. So 25 years ago today, on the morning, I came to. I had gone AWOL a few weeks earlier. I was in the Air Force. I played in the Air Force band. And so to this day, I'm still the only person I know who went AWOL from the band. And so, but the reason I went AWOL is because I knew I wasn't going to stop drinking. I'd been getting into like little minor trouble in the Air Force because of my drinking. And I was able to shield it enough where the people in the band didn't know about the drinking. They knew there was something wrong with me, but they didn't know that it was drinking. And I would make up excuses like, you know, hey, I'm a New Yorker, I'm not used to being here, or just whatever, dumb excuses, right? And so, but I knew deep down that, hey, one day they're gonna find out. And I was living this double life where during the day I would go to Langley with the perfect uniform on. I'd be there 30 minutes early and I would warm up and be ready to play and play great form, and everything was wonderful. And then at night I would drive around bar hopping, picking up hookers and living this debaucherous life. And the biggest thing that I was afraid of was that the people during the day, I gotta find out what I'm doing at night. And I was just trying to live these two lives and keep them separated. And it was just getting harder and harder and harder. I would get an occasional visit, or my commander, my conductor, would call me into his office and say, Ray, what's going on with you? What's going on? And I would make these excuses. And then I would tell myself, you know, man, I gotta stop drinking for a little while. Because I was drinking every day, and heavy every day. And I would tell myself, you know, I just got to stop for just a little while. Never forever, you know, but just for a little while. Just, you know, catch up on some bills and maybe give my body a little bit of a rest or something. And I just could not do it. I couldn't stop for a day. I couldn't stop for a day. And every day, like, I would go to Langley every day, and I would be in constant fear. I'd be driving to Langley, and I would think, is today the day? Is today the day that someone's going to call me in and say, we know what you're doing, Ray. We know what you're doing. And so I lived with that fear all the time. All the time. And every day that I would get through and nothing would happen, I'd be like, oh, thank God. But then I would go back to drinking anyway. I just, when I'm a very typical alcoholic. When I start drinking, I have no control over the amount that I'm going to drink. I have no control whatsoever. But to me, the real kicker of alcoholism is when I'm not drinking. And my first sponsor said that all the time. The real insanity of alcoholism does not occur when I'm drinking. Because when I'm drinking and all the stupid stuff that I do when I'm drinking is par for the course. This is what alcoholics do when we're drinking. We do stupid stuff. The real kicker is when I'm not drinking and I think about drinking. That's crazy. If you're an alcoholic like me, you shouldn't want to drink. And here I was constantly thinking about drinking and thinking about how it's going to be different this time. Or I'm going to start drinking a little later in the evening. Maybe I'm going to drink a big meal so that I don't get as drunk later on. I would do stuff like, you know, I would, after work at Langley, I wouldn't drive straight to the bar. I'd go home. I love doing puzzles. I had this was before smartphones. I had stacks and stacks of puzzle books. And I would go home and I'd just do puzzle after puzzle after puzzle just to try and get my mind off of, like, drinking. And it would work for a few hours, but then, you know, my hand would get tired from doing all those puzzles. But I would keep trying, like, to fight it. And sometimes I would even be, it would be late and I would be in bed. Like, I'd gone through the day and I hadn't had a drink and I'd be in bed, but something would always get me up again. You know, they would just, something would just tell me, there's something going on, you gotta see it, you gotta be there. It was just, it was so insane. And so around Christmas time, so I was in the band and we'd played a concert in Williamsburg. We played a concert in Colonial Williamsburg. And after the concert, we went on leave. Because that's what military bands typically do, since everybody has to be together to work, then we all take our vacations at the same time. So I went on leave and I drove to New York and I tried to reconcile with an old girlfriend who wanted nothing to do with me because of my drunkenness and the stupid stuff that I was doing. And during that trip, I don't know what happened exactly, but during that trip, I just sort of knew that I was never gonna stop drinking. Like I was condemned to this. Like this life that I had been living, it was just gonna be like this all the time. That scared me more than dying. Like dying was something that I almost fantasized about. Like I wish it would be over. But the idea of living this way for a long time is what really, really scared me. And I remember I was in my car. I drove a Dodge Shadow back then, so it was always like, it was me and my shadow. That's how I always thought of it, me and my shadow. And so I drove this Dodge Shadow, and I was on Route 13, can't remember exactly where, but I was on Route 13 heading back to Langley. The leave was over, and I was heading back to Langley, and I don't know what happened, but I had gotten to an intersection, and it was a red light, and while I'm waiting for the red light, this thought came to me, and I was like, you know what? I won't say exactly because I don't want to cuss in this church or anything, but I said, F it, is what I said. But I didn't say F, right? And when the light turned green, I did a U-turn and decided not to go back to Langley. Right in that moment, I decided to go AWOL from the Air Force. So what did I do? I went in the opposite direction. I found a little flea bag motel on the side of the road, paid for a night. I asked the guy, hey, is there a bar somewhere nearby, somewhere where I can go drink? He says, yeah, there's a bar right up the road, but it's a gay bar. And I said, I didn't care. and so I went to this gay bar. I'm not gay, by the way. I went to this gay bar, and And I'm drinking, and weird thing about being in that gay bar, I did a lot of drinking, but I didn't spend too much money. I don't understand how that happened. but I'm in this gay bar, and I'm just drinking, and so after that night, I just got in the car, drove somewhere else, don't know exactly where, and did the same thing. And I did this day after day after day. I don't know where I was going, but I would just drive somewhere. I remember being a couple of places. I remember doing this during this journey. I drove to Times Square in New York City, and that's where I got my bald head. Was during this final drinking spree. I had a buzz cut because I was in the Air Force, and clean shaven face. And then I let my facial hair grow and got rid of the hair and went completely bald. Somehow in my mind, I thought, you know, they're looking for me and I needed to change my look. A lot of insanity going on up here during that time. I remember going to New York City. I remember being in Montpelier, Vermont. I went all the way up there. Just a bunch of different places, random, just driving. And then when I didn't feel like driving anymore, I would stop and find a place to stay and then just drink. And by the way, I had in my possession the Air Force credit card, and I was using the Air Force credit card to fund my drinking spree. So this is going on, and then on the 12th of January, 1998, I did the same thing like I had done all the previous days. I came to, I drove somewhere, I found a bar, and I was drinking. And I've thought about this a few times. Was there anything different on the 12th than, say, on the 11th or the 10th? Like, maybe somebody said something that kind of triggered something in my head, or maybe there was some weird thing that happened. And I've thought about it for quite a while, and no, it was all the same. And, you know, I think the drinking life, you know, for us alcoholics, it really is kind of boring. You drink, you get drunk, you pass out. You drink, you get drunk, you pass out. And that's just what I did every day. And so that day before my sobriety date was no different than any of the other days. So what happened on January 13th? I did come to that morning, but it's not like I came to and had like an awakening in that moment. I didn't have that at all. I came to, and my plan was just to continue to do the same thing that I had been doing. I was gonna drive somewhere, find a place to drink, get drunk, pass out, the key, pass out, and hope to not come to, because that was the big thing during that spree. I drank mass quantities, and I really wanted to die. That's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to die. I just wanted it to be over. My mind was made up, but my body wouldn't quit. It kept living. And I was pissed. Every morning that I would like come to, I would be mad. I'd be mad at God. Why am I still here? Why didn't this do it this time? And so on the morning of January 13th, the plan was the same, but the circumstances were different. So what happened that morning, I came to, and I didn't stay in a motel or anything like that. I was in a municipal parking lot in Concord, Massachusetts. It was a Monday morning. Excuse me, it was a Tuesday morning. And I was just gonna do the same thing again, but I didn't have any gas in my car. Right, so I was out of gas, couldn't drive anywhere. But I figured, hey, I got money, I'll walk around this town I'd never been in before. I'll buy a gas can, I'll put some gas in it and walk back to my car and put the gas in my car and then go on my merry way. I didn't have any cash on me, but I had plenty of money in the bank, and so I went to the bank, and I couldn't get any money out of the bank, even though I had quite a bit of money in the bank. I just couldn't get any money. And I learned later on that the Air Force had frozen my bank account. But I couldn't get any money out. I called the bank, they said, yes, you got this money, but I have no access to it. And And I'm getting really, really scared at this point. Like, I think of all the days of my drunkenness, in a weird way, my sobriety date was the one day that I really wanted to drink. Like, I really wanted to drink that day. And I just couldn't get that drink. I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it. And then I had this moment. I think it was a God moment. I think it was a spiritual awakening of some sort. And God talked to me. And he didn't say anything really deep. He didn't say anything like, you know, he didn't quote scripture or anything like that. He just said, turn yourself into the police. That's what I heard the voice tell me. And I know that wasn't me, because I would never tell myself to turn, you know, to turn myself into the police. And so, so that was one miracle. But I think the bigger miracle was what happened after that. I saw a cop right away. And I did what I never do, like that inner voice, you know, inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. And I think God is always trying to speak to us, trying to get us to do the right thing, to tell us something. And I was a guy that, although I always believed that God existed, I'm not an atheist or anything, but to me, God was up there doing his thing. I'm down here doing my thing, and we have nothing to do with each other. That's the way I always thought of God. And so I never obeyed the voice. And to me, the miracle that day was that when I heard the voice, I obeyed the voice. This time I did what God had told me to do. And the reason why I obeyed is not because I'm an obedient person. It's because I was a desperate person. I was a scared person. I didn't know what else to do. So it was the only thing I could think of doing. I may as well do this. And so I went up to this cop, and I told him. I said, look, I've gone AWOL from the Air Force. I've been doing a lot of drinking. I'm in trouble. That's what I told him. And then a series of events, this cop, I wish I knew who he was, this cop drove me to the nearest Air Force base. He got me in direct contact with the military police on this Air Force base. And then the military police, at first, it was just kind of a common thing. Oh, you've gone AWOL. Here's a form. Fill it out, and we'll get you back to your base, and then your base will figure out what to do with you, right? So on the form, it asks questions about drinking and about being suicidal. And I answered the questions as honestly as I could. I didn't try to BS them. I told them what was going on. And when they saw that, they were like, oh, we got to do something else here. And so they called a doctor, an Air Force doctor, psychiatrist. She came and talked to me. And it was this psychiatrist that made the pronouncement for the first time in my life. She said, Airman Rosario, you're an alcoholic, and you need to go to a hospital now. That's what she said. And the urgency in her voice, like, you are in really serious trouble here. That had an impact on me. And so they made arrangements really fast and got me to a civilian hospital, Emerson Hospital, Concord, Massachusetts. And they cleaned me up and got me, you know, the fluids that I needed and all this stuff. And then another miracle happened. The hospital staff, I guess, they had some kind of decent relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous, because there was an AA meeting in that hospital that night. And of course, I didn't know there was a meeting in the hospital, but they knew, and they also knew that I needed to be in the meeting. And so they took me to my first AA meeting, a different floor in the hospital, but they took me to that meeting, got me to the room. And it was a nice room, kind of like a day room, maybe slightly smaller than this. I was the only person in the meeting that was a patient of the hospital. Everybody else was just regular clothes like you guys, in the meeting, looking good, presentable. Here I am with an IV pole. I'm wearing a hospital gown, you know, those terrible hospital gowns that don't close all the way in the back. And I just look really pathetic. And they had the meeting. I'm sure they were talking about a lot of great things in the meeting, but I have no clue what they were saying. I spent most of the meeting just kind of sitting there with my hand in my head and just thinking to myself, how did a nice guy like me wind up in an AA meeting? I just thought that was like the worst thing in the world. And then at the end of the meeting, they did chips. And I did not get up to pick up a white chip. I had no intention to do it. But the chairman walked over to me and put a white chip in my hand. I think that was kind of God's way of saying, you need this, right? You need this chip. You need something. If you're not smart enough to get it yourself, I'm going to get it to you. And so this chairman put the white chip in my hand. And he said, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. It's the first message I ever heard in alcoholics that actually stuck, was you never have to drink again if you don't want to. And my experience had been, I was condemned to drink. I did not really think that was true. But somehow when he said it, I kind of believed him, kind of. Or maybe I just wanted to believe him, I'm not sure. But it was different. And so I was able to sleep pretty well that night. And then the next morning, the Air Force sent an escort to pick me up. The two of us got on an airplane. We flew to Washington, D.C. And I was checked into a rehab center on Andrews Air Force Base. And then the escort left. And then I was in the care of Andrews Air Force Base at this rehab center. And I don't know if any of you have ever been in a military rehab center, but they kind of base things on rank. And while I was there, I was the ranking person in the rehab center. So yeah, I'll put that on my resume. So one of the things that the ranking person had to do was when the people there had their own AA meeting in-house, it was up to me to conduct the meeting. And here I am, I never conducted it. I don't know anything about AA, and here I am trying to do a meeting, and someone had suggested, well, you should do like a big book study. Okay, so we all had big books. And the way I thought about the big book study is, I'm looking through the table of contents, let me find the shortest chapter there is, and we're gonna read it together, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit. And even in that weird kind of haphazard way, it still was effective. I was still reading someone else's experience, strength, and hope. So it worked, it still worked. I remember at my first outside of the facility AA meeting. We got on a van and we went to a meeting in Washington, D.C. It was a bunch of old timers. I'm guessing they were old timers anyway. They're hanging out, they're smoking cigarettes outside, and they're laughing and joking. They're just having a great time. And I just thought, hey, this looks like, you know, a lot of fun. These guys are having a good time. It was weird. They were having a good time, but I knew they were drunks too, so that it didn't jive with me at first. Like, how can you be a drunk and still be like happy and have fun and stuff? And then somebody in the meeting had bought me my first big book in 12 and 12, and just bought it and just gave it to me. And he said, someday if you get sober, you can buy a big book in a 12 and 12 for somebody else. And I've done that a number of times over the years. But I remember that night being in the facility with my brand new big book in 12 and 12, and I'm opening up the big book and I'm just kind of leafing through the table of contents, and I see a chapter called Two Employers. First thing I ever read in the big book was Two Employers. Not even the whole Two Employers. I just read like the first maybe page and a half, two pages of it. Let me make sure my time is good. Yeah, I'm okay. And so I read the first couple of pages, and if you don't know Two Employers, basically the employer doesn't understand alcoholism, and as a result, he had a couple of employees commit suicide. And so I thought, wow, okay, this is interesting. I think, and I came up with this brilliant idea. I came up with all my own, I promise. So I said, I think I should make photocopies of these first couple of pages and give it to my employer. I really thought it was a good idea. I really did, right? And so, I thought it was such a good idea that the next morning we had a meeting, just us patients, and I mentioned it to them. And they all laughed at me. They laughed at me and they said, "Ray, you're full of it. Don't do it. You're crazy." And again, I obeyed the voice. Now, the first time I obeyed the voice, it was the voice of God. This time I obeyed the voice and it was the voice of my fellow patients, which was God in disguise, I think. And so I didn't do it. And later on, I told my first sponsor this story, and he says, "Ray, you don't realize it, but what you did a step three is what you did, Ray. You turned your will and life over to a higher power. You told the group what you were planning on doing, what you were thinking about doing, and then the group gave you feedback. They gave you feedback that was nothing vague about it. Like, they let you know, Ray, don't do this, don't do this, and then you listened to them. That's really turning your will and life over to God in a really simple way." And so I've, you know, long before I even started working steps, like the steps were already starting to work me in my infancy of sobriety. So after I got through treatment, a couple of guys from the Air Force band came and picked me up and drove me back to Langley. I met with my commander and I met with my first sergeant. And they both said, "Ray, we've made a decision. We decided that we're not going to keep you in the band. Like, we're going to separate you from Air Force service." And I was crushed. I was devastated by it. Because despite what I had been doing, I really, really loved that job. Like, to me, that was the dream job. When I was a little kid growing up in the Bronx, we went on a field trip to Carnegie Hall. And I got to watch the Air Force band play at Carnegie Hall. And I told myself as a kid, that's what I want to do in life. And that's what I was doing. But that dream and that desire was not strong enough to keep me from drinking. Like, when you're an alcoholic and you're drinking, you might have the best reasons in the world not to drink. But if you don't have a higher power, you're doomed. You're absolutely doomed. And I was doomed. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter why. I just was absolutely doomed. So I was devastated by this news. And of course, the military, it doesn't just happen like that. You know, they don't tell you that you're gone and then a week later you're gone. You got to go through quite a few things first. And it took a few months. So in the meantime, I was assigned a doctor on Langley. And so in my mind, it became, okay, my job now is to convince the doctor, because the doctor was going to give him reports, like, this is how he's doing, right? So my job was to convince the doctor that I was doing really, really well, that I really got a good handle on this sobriety thing, and that they should change their mind and let me stay in the band. And so what did I do to convince the doctor? I did 90 meetings in 90 days. I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps. And I didn't do it out of, you know, hey, I want to be sober, and I want to get closer to God, and I want to be a better human being. I didn't do it for those reasons. I did it to convince the doctor. That's why I did it. So I didn't even have good reasons to do it. But what I learned is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If you want what we have, you do what we do, right? And it doesn't matter why you do it. I was doing it for selfish reasons. It didn't matter. I got sober. So I tell anybody in this room, if you don't want to get sober, don't work the steps. Don't do it, because you're going to get sober, even if you don't want to. Even if you don't want to. We have a great guy in our home group, Richard, likes to say sobriety is like the recipe for a cake. If you put the ingredients in and you follow the instructions, you're going to get a cake. You don't have to believe in cake. You don't even have to want cake. But if you do what it tells you to do, you will get a cake. And so if you do this thing, you will get sobriety. It just will happen. And so I will say this, though. I got a little time. Just because you work the steps and you get a spiritual awakening and you get sober doesn't necessarily mean you're going to stay sober. You know, because what I have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And God's not a maintenance man, right? It's like, it's up to me to do the maintenance. It's totally up to me. And when I don't do the maintenance, and this is a story I always like to tell, 2010, at this point I'm about 13 years sober. If you looked at my life in 2010, you would think, man, this guy's really got it going on. I started some Spanish AA meetings on the peninsula. I had just gotten married. We're going on our honeymoon. We're going to San Antonio, Texas, the 2010 International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a guest speaker at one of the meetings at the 2010 International Convention. And that same night, my new wife and I got into a fight. I had a resentment, and I had decided to go get drunk the same night that I had spoken at a meeting earlier. Now, I didn't get drunk. But what happened was I was standing outside a bar in San Antonio, getting ready to go in and take a drink. But I had this t-shirt on. It said, friend of Bill since January 13, 1998. And I'm like, man, I can't go into a bar with this shirt on, right? And so, it was a shirt that my ex-wife had made for us. She'd made these shirts for us. And I turned the shirt inside out. You could still see it. You could still see the writing on the shirt. I was like, damn, I can't go in, right? And you would think, you know, after 13 years of sobriety and this close call, that maybe I would have felt, man, thank you, God. That was a close call. Thank you for saving me. But that's not how I felt. I was pissed. I was pissed that I couldn't take the drink. I wanted to take the drink so bad, and I couldn't take it. The circumstances didn't let me take it. So what did I do? Didn't feel like I could go back to the hotel. I'm just wandering around in San Antonio, doing nothing, just walking around. And then I remembered, they have marathon meetings during these things. So they had on one floor marathon meetings in Spanish, and then they had on another floor marathon meetings in English. And I was just kind of going back and forth between the two. And somewhere in the middle of the night, I went to a meeting, and a guy at the podium talked about how he had gotten drunk at the 2005 International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, wow, I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that. Somewhere in our big book, it says that if we're spiritually fit, we can go anywhere and do anything. And so I believe that if I'm spiritually fit, there is no dangerous place for me. I could go into a bar if I needed to go there for whatever reason. And I had done that in sobriety and never had any problems. I could go wherever if I'm spiritually fit. What that experience told me is that if I'm not spiritually fit, there's no safe place. Like, I could be at the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous and still get drunk if I'm not spiritually fit. And so, to me, the key is not where I am or anything like that. It's spiritual fitness. I must maintain my spiritual fitness if I'm going to survive in this world. And so I'm grateful that I know that today, and I'm grateful that I survived that close call. I think everybody who's kind of meandering in the steps should be granted the gift of a close call like the one that I had. Because what it did was it said, Ray, you got to get back to work. I went back home. I got with my sponsor, told him what was happening. I said, I got to work the steps again. I got to do this again. And so from that day to this day, I have not stopped working steps. Either I'm working them with my sponsor, I'm working them with a sponsee, I'm keeping my head in the literature, I'm praying, I'm meditating, and just trying to do the best I can. Not perfect, of course. Nobody works this program perfectly, but I'm doing these things to the best of my ability, and I think God will take me the rest of the way. You know, I think God will get me there the rest of the way if I just do my best. Over the years, I've had a lot of interesting experiences in sobriety. I've gotten to do some service work. I've been my group's GSR, an alternate GSR. I've been the district committee member in Virginia. I've even been a sound guy. I was the sound guy for a couple of years at the Virginia Area Committee of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that service commitment was really fantastic. I got to go to places and do things that most AAers don't get to do. I got to meet the p- people of the General Service Office and all of these really cool things. And I'm just, to me, I'm what my first sponsor called, I'm a cookie cutter alcoholic. I'm just like every other alcoholic. Nothing really special about me, you know. And he would say, you know, because I came into AA thinking that I was unique, that, hey, I'm a band guy, and I was in the Air Force, and I had this prestigious job and all that. And he says, no, Ray, you're a cookie cutter. You're a cookie cutter alcoholic, and the program that works for that lady over there and that works for that guy over here is the same program that'll work for you too. You just have to do it, Ray. You know, AA is not for people who need it. It's not for people who want it. It's for people who do it. It's for people who do this. And so I just know from my experience that when I don't work this program, the drink is just an arm's length away. It's just an arm's length away. But when I do work this program, miraculous things happen. And again, my name is Ray. I'm an alcoholic. I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. Then I had a reawakening as a result of the steps again. And because of all that, I'm a guy who doesn't drink and doesn't think about drinking. And if you're a real alcoholic like me, you know how awesome that is. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Ray.